The Tenth Amendment generally underscores the division of authority between the federal and state governments. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively, or to the people. But what was the purpose of this new federal system? Along with limiting federal power and separating that power among three competing branches, the federal system would also ensure that the Revolution's principles, as set forth in the Declaration of Independence, and the civil society itself would be safeguarded. States are governmental entities that reflect the personalities, characteristics, histories, and priorities of the individuals who choose to inhabit them. They have diverse geographies, climates, resources, and populations. No two states are alike. The same can be said of the cities, towns, and hamlets within the states, which number in the tens of thousands and dot the nation's landscape. States are more likely to better reflect the interests of their citizens than the federal government. Localities are even more likely to better reflect those interests, because the decision-makers come from the communities they govern. They are directly affected by their own decisions. Moreover, the interaction between the people and their representatives at the state and local levels is easier and more direct. When the federal government acts beyond its constitutional limits, it assaults the purest form of representative government by supplanting representative decision-making at the state and local levels. The federal government cannot possibly comprehend the diversity of interests that are affected by its decision-making. It cannot adequately weigh the costs and benefits of its decisions on communities. Besides, that is not its purpose. It seeks to dictate rather than represent. Federalism has other profound benefits. As Associate Justice Louis D. Brandeis wrote, "A single courageous state may, if its citizens choose, serve as a laboratory and try novel social and economic experiments without risk to the rest of the country." For the framers, experimentation, like change, was a matter of prudence. As previously described, change should be informed by the experience, knowledge, and traditions of society, tailored for a specific purpose, and accomplished through a constitutional construct that ensures thoughtful deliberation by the community. Change unconstrained by prudence produces unpredictable consequences, threatening ordered liberty with chaos, and ultimately despotism, and placing at risk the very principles the conservative holds dear. Therefore, while Brandeis was right to acknowledge the import of states in experimenting with public policy, his use of the word novel suggests open-ended or unconstrained experimentation. Whatever kind of experimentation states and local communities may engage in, it is correct to say that they serve as useful examples for adoption, modification, or rejection by other states and localities. In the 1980s, Oregon's welfare reform experiment was so successful that it became a model not only for other states, but also for the federal government. Milwaukee's experiment with school vouchers sparked similar efforts across the country. Experimentation, properly understood, is a dynamic characteristic of federalism, which exists among, between, and within the various states. That is not to say that all experimentation produces desirable results. When Maryland passed a computer services tax, its burgeoning technology sector threatened to relocate to neighboring Virginia, which had no such tax. Maryland repealed the tax, but other states learned from Maryland's experience. Mobility is perhaps the most important aspect of federalism. If the individual concludes he is hopelessly bound by what he considers to be a harmful decision by state or local authorities, he may, in the end, choose to live elsewhere, where the economic, cultural, or social conditions are more to his liking. Indeed, throughout American history, individuals of all races, ages, and income levels have moved from one state to another, either because they are escaping adverse conditions, or simply because they are seeking greener pastures. For example, today large industrial states, which burden their citizens and businesses with high taxes and excessive regulations, are depopulating themselves. Individuals are taking their assets and moving to other parts of the country. Some are moving to states like Florida or Nevada because they have no income tax. Or they are relocating their businesses to Alabama because it is a right-to-work state. People move to different states for infinite reasons. Federalism promotes decentralized government, which empowers the individual to choose whether to stay in one place and try to influence the state and local decision-making, or to take up residence in another state or locality. There is no escaping the reach of the federal government, however, unless one gives up on the country altogether and leaves for other shores. Federalism also diffuses conflict and even promotes harmony. A strong proponent of the death penalty can live in Texas, which has the most active execution chamber, and not care much that New Jersey just abolished the punishment. Individuals with widely divergent beliefs are able to coexist in the same country because of the diversity and tolerance federalism promotes. However, one of the most dramatic events undermining state constitutional authority came with the ratification of the 17th Amendment on April 8, 1913. The 17th Amendment changed the method by which senators were chosen, from being selected by the state legislatures, ensuring that the state governments would have a direct and meaningful voice in the operation of the federal government, to direct popular election by the citizens of each state. A rising tide of progressivism and populism resulted in enough states ratifying the amendment that they largely disenfranchised themselves from the federal lawmaking process. Even with the elimination of their direct representation in the Senate, the states independently possessed considerable authority under the Constitution. Consequently, for the statist, federalism, like free markets and private property, remained a major obstacle to amassing power. Therefore, he would have to subvert the Constitution to achieve his ends, which he did. The Constitution's Interstate Commerce Clause had as its purpose the promotion of commerce and trade among the states. However, in 1942, the Supreme Court ruled in Wickard v. Filburn that a farmer growing wheat on his own land and for his own use was still subject to federal production limits, even though none of his wheat ever left the state. The court reasoned that by withholding his wheat from commerce, the farmer was affecting interstate commerce, even though there was no commerce, let alone interstate commerce. This meant that private economic activity conducted for the sole purpose of self-consumption and occurring wholly within a state's borders would now be subject to federal regulatory authority under the Agricultural Adjustment Act. Wickard swept away 150 years of constitutional jurisprudence, decentralized governmental authority, and private property rights protection. And with it, the judiciary seized a role for itself. The manipulation of law to promote a statist agenda that continues to this day. Indeed, through a succession of laws and rulings, all three branches, the judicial, the legislative, and the executive, now routinely exercise power well beyond their specific enumerated authority under the Constitution. In many respects, the once powerful states, 13 of which ratified the Constitution in the first place, have themselves become administrative appendages of the federal government. It is not enough that the federal government exercises authority reserved to the states, but it also blackmails the states to implement its policies by threatening to deny them their fair share of federal tax dollars should they object. In fact, so complete is the federal government's authority over the states that it heavily regulates and even monitors them to ensure their compliance with federal dictates. Does anyone believe that the states would have originally ratified the Constitution had they known this would be their fate? The statist has also constructed a fourth branch of government, an enormous administrative state, which exists to oversee and implement his policies. It is a massive yet amorphous bureaucracy that consists of a workforce of nearly 2 million civilian employees. It administers a budget of over $3 trillion a year. It churns out a mind-numbing number of rules that regulate energy, the environment, business, labor, employment, transportation, housing, agriculture, food, drugs, education, etc. Even the slightest human activity apparently requires its intervention. Clothing labels on women's dresses, cosmetics ingredients, and labeling. It even reaches into the bathroom, mandating showerhead flow rates and allowable gallons per flush for toilets. It sets flammability standards for beds. There are nearly 1,000 federal departments, agencies, and divisions that make laws and enforce them. The official compilation of rules issued by the federal government, the Federal Register, contained 74,937 pages of regulations in 2006. Tolstoy's War and Peace, only 1,400 pages in length, seems as light and airy as a romance novel by comparison. The rules in the Federal Register are written in a dense and confusing style, often confounding the lawyers, accountants, businessmen, and others required to digest them. The estimated cost of simply complying with these regulations was $1.14 trillion. The National Taxpayers Union estimated that in 2006, U.S. businesses and individuals spent 6.65 billion hours struggling to comply with the complexities of the tax code, at a cost of $156.5 billion in lost productivity for businesses alone. All branches of the federal government, elected and unelected, have consumed more and more of the governing authority of states and localities, leaving them less room to exercise their discretion. In doing so, the federal government is imposing its will directly on communities and citizens in contravention of the Constitution. Consequently, there has been a fundamental breakdown of the federal system. Having spent decades fighting and losing legal challenges to federal encroachment, states have for the most part accepted the role the statist has assigned to them. Many governors have become politically expedient on the subject, arguing schizophrenically for federal intervention while defending state preeminence. Even worse, a type of crony federalism now exists, whereby states lobby the federal government for advantage or relief. It works like this. States convince the federal government to fund projects within their own borders by taxing the citizens of other states. In the name of stimulating the economy, states, counties, cities, and towns have compiled long lists of pork projects they want paid for by the federal taxpayer. They are also asking the federal government to bail them out from their own deficits. For the statist, the voluntary surrender of state and local authority to the federal government is to be encouraged. Moreover, states with more onerous regulatory standards often urge the federal government to impose those standards on other states to level the playing field. Individuals, unions, and businesses also seek federal intervention to supplant state decisions that they do not like. The statist's most successful rhetorical attack on federalism involves slavery and civil rights. He asks, how can the conservative defend federalism when state governments were responsible for enslaving and oppressing African Americans? It is a misreading of history to singularly condemn federalism for slavery. While there is no debating or excusing that Southern states sanctioned slavery, at times they did so with the help of the federal government. Moreover, there is also no questioning that other states, mostly in the North, instituted policies and laws not only prohibiting slavery within their own borders, but defying efforts by the Southern states and the federal government to enforce slavery in the South. For example, prior to the Civil War, and at the behest of the Southern states, in 1793 and 1850, the federal fugitive slave laws were enacted to force recalcitrant Northern states to return escaped slaves to their Southern owners. many northern states resisted by passing personal liberty laws, which created legal obstacles to the deportation of slaves back to the South. In the 1842 Prigg v. Pennsylvania case, the federal Supreme Court ruled these laws unconstitutional, arguing that they sought to preempt federal law, although it added that the northern states were not required to affirmatively assist the southern states that sought the return of escaped slaves. In 1857, the court ruled in Dred Scott v. Sanford that no slaves or descendants of slaves could be U.S. citizens, and that Congress's Missouri Compromise of 1820, which prohibited slavery in much of the new territories, was unconstitutional, for it denied slave owners their personal property rights. As a result, the court not only denied the slave the ability to escape one state's tyranny for another state's freedom, a direct assault on a critical aspect of federalism, mobility, but it actually expanded slavery throughout the country, which helped precipitate the Civil War. Furthermore, not until 1862 did the federal government abolish slavery in the District of Columbia, which was wholly controlled by federal authorities. Therefore, the statist can be asked, how can you defend an all-powerful federal government given its role in promoting slavery? Slavery was a contentious issue not only between the states, but also within the states, including in towns and counties in southern states. It was contentious not only between the federal government and the states, but within the federal government, as between Congress and the president, and between the elected branches and the Supreme Court. The oppression of African Americans was never compatible with the civil society, although some northern state delegates recognized this fact and sought to abolish slavery at the Constitutional Convention. The southern states would not unite behind such a constitution. It is all the more remarkable, therefore, that certain compromises were reached with the southern state delegates respecting slavery. The constitution they adopted empowered Congress to prohibit the importation of slaves to the United States in 20 years' time, which it did. It reduced the influence southern states would have in the House of Representatives by counting slaves as 3/5 persons for the purpose of apportioning seats. Unfortunately, the southern states did succeed in inserting language requiring the return of slaves who escaped to other states. However, the Constitution did not, as some contend, compel the practice of slavery. But it must be emphasized that had not the Constitution been adopted, and had the southern states either formed their own nation or simply existed on their own, the institution of slavery would most certainly have survived longer than it did. There would have been no southern state secession, because there would have been no union of northern and southern states in the first place. The Constitution's ratification by the southern states would ultimately mark the beginning of the end of slavery, coming to fruition with their defeat in the Civil War, and the subsequent adoption by Congress and the states of the following amendments to the Constitution: the 13th, formally abolishing slavery; the 14th, prohibiting the abridgment of citizens' rights; and the 15th, prohibiting race as a bar to voting. A nation founded on the self-evident truth that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, could not forever tolerate slavery within its midst. And it did not. For the conservative, the lesson comes back to man's imperfection. Even good men are capable of bad things. The disgrace of slavery is a disgrace of the human condition, as is all tyranny. Man's institutions, like man himself, are imperfect. They can be used for good or bad, and they have been used for both. Therefore, diffusing authority among many imperfect men, by enumerating federal power, separating power within the federal government, and sharing power with the states, isolates and limits tyranny. Had slavery been affirmed in the Constitution and urged on all states, who knows when and how it would have been abolished? The conservative acknowledges that there are occasions when it is difficult to discern the legitimate and preferred demarcation between the different parts and levels of government. But unlike the statist, he earnestly endeavors to find them. For example, he accepts today, as certain conservatives may not have yesterday, that the Civil Rights Acts of the 1960s, while excessive in their application in some respects, such as imposing overly broad speech and behavior codes on universities, secular goals on religious institutions, and a wide range of employment and housing restrictions, which ultimately embrace an authoritarian approach that threatens civil liberties, were the proper exercise of federal statutory authority under the 14th Amendment to address intransigent state racism against African Americans. For the statist, however, the advantage of a federal government monopoly without effective challenge from a diversity of states or their citizens is obvious. It is a pathway to his precious utopia, where, in the end, all are enslaved in one form or another. In Federalist 39, James Madison wrote in part, "Each state, in ratifying the Constitution, is considered as a sovereign body, independent of all others, and only to be bound by its own voluntary act. In this relation, then, the new Constitution will, if established, be a federal and not a national Constitution." Of course, today it is more national than federal. Chapter 6. On the Free Market. The free market is the most transformative of economic systems. It fosters creativity and inventiveness. It produces new industries, products, and services as it improves upon existing ones. With millions of individuals freely engaged in an infinite number and variety of transactions each day, it is impossible to even conceive all the changes and plans for changes occurring in our economy at any given time. The free market creates more wealth and opportunities for more people than any other economic model. But the conservative believes that the individual is more than a producer and consumer of material goods. He exists within the larger context of the civil society, which provides for an ordered liberty. The conservative sees in the free market the harmony of interests and rules of cooperation that also underlie the civil society. For example, the free market promotes self-worth, self-sufficiency, shared values, and honest dealings, which enhance the individual, the family, and the community. It discriminates against no race, religion, or gender. The truck driver does not know the skin color of the individuals who produce the diesel fuel for his vehicle. The cook does not know the religion of the dairy farmers who supply milk to his restaurant. And the airline passenger does not know the gender of the factory workers who manufacture the commercial aircraft that transports him. Nor do they care. The free market is an intricate system of voluntary economic, social, and cultural interactions that are motivated by the desires and needs of the individual and the community. The conservative believes that while the symmetry between the free market and the civil society is imperfect, that is, not all developments resulting from individual interactions contribute to the overall well-being of the civil society, one simply cannot exist without the other. The key to understanding the free market is private property. Private property is the material manifestation of the individual's labor. The material value created from the intellectual and/or physical labor of the individual, which may take the form of income, real property, or intellectual property. Just as life is finite, so too is the extent of one's labor. Therefore, taxation of private property, or the regulation of such property so as to reduce its value, can become in effect a form of servitude, particularly if the disposition results from illegitimate and arbitrary state action. Hence, the conservative believes that the federal government should raise revenue only to fund those activities that the Constitution authorizes, and no others. Otherwise, what are the limits on the statist's power to tax and regulate the individual's labor, and ultimately enslave him? The Marxist class struggle formulation, which pits the proletariat, working class, against the bourgeoisie, wealthy merchant class, still serves as the principal theoretical and rhetorical justification for the statists' assault on the free market. But it is anathema to the free market, in that the individual has unto himself the power to make of himself what he chooses. There is no static class structure layered atop the free market. The free market is a mutable, dynamic, and vibrant system of individual interactions that engages all aspects of the human character. For this reason, the conservative believes the free market is a vital bulwark against statism, and it would appear the statist agrees, for he is relentless in his assault on it. Indeed, the statist's rejection of the Constitution's limits on federal power is justified primarily, albeit not exclusively, on material grounds. In the name of economic justice and equality, the statist creates the perception of class struggle through a variety of inventions, including the progressive income tax. In the Communist Manifesto, Karl Marx wrote, "In the most advanced countries, the following will be pretty generally applicable: a heavy progressive or graduated income tax." A recent study by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development found that when measuring household taxes, income taxes, and employee social security contributions, the United States has the most progressive tax system and collects the largest share of taxes from the richest 10% of the population, placing a heavier tax burden on high-income households than other industrialized nations do. The latest Congressional Budget Office figures show that the top 1% of income earners in the United States paid 39% of federal income taxes while earning 18% of pre-tax income, and the top 5% of income earners paid 61% of federal income taxes while earning 31% of pre-tax income. Indeed, the top 40% of income earners paid 99.4% of federal income taxes. The bottom 40% of income earners paid no federal income tax and received 3.8% from the tax system. And the middle 20% of income earners pay only 4.4% of federal income taxes. While the conservative, like Adam Smith, does not object to wealthier individuals paying more to finance the legitimate functions of government, the government has grown well beyond the limits placed on it by the Constitution, particularly since the New Deal. Redistributing wealth is a central objective of the progressive income tax, which Marx would endorse and Smith would reject. For the statist, there must be a class struggle, and it must be a never-ending struggle. For it is perhaps his most valuable weapon in his war against the individual, the free market, and ultimately, the civil society. The statist, therefore, not only opposes efforts to eliminate the progressive income tax, including such alternatives as the fair tax, a national sales tax, or the flat tax, a flat rate income tax. He opposes most any income tax reductions that might weaken the class structure. Inasmuch as economic equality is unachievable, even in the most repressive socialist states, it serves the statist's purpose to contrive a class system in which individuals are grouped by officially sanctioned arbitrary economic categories. In this way, the statist stirs up class envy. The free market is therefore said to be incapable of serving the public interest, for it produces unjust results, thereby requiring further government intervention. The statist also attempts to manipulate the intensity of the class struggle by routinely redefining terms and categories of wealth. Who qualifies as the detested rich, the righteous middle class, and the disenfranchised poor? But it is the so-called middle class that is the object of the statist's exploitations. He believes if he can win the working man's favor, he can win the day. As Marxist community organizer Saul Alinsky explained in Rules for Radicals, "Organization for Action will now and in the decade ahead center upon America's white middle class. That is where the power is. When more than three-fourths of our people, from both the point of view of economics and of their self-identification, are middle class, it is obvious that their action or inaction will determine the direction of change. Large parts of the middle class, the silent majority, must be activated. Action and articulation are one, as are silence and surrender.